Knowledge Products presents Karl Marx, Das Kapital, Part 4.
We will now consider what some people believe is the most serious difficulty in Marx's theory of value. Volume 1 of Capital appeared in 1867. Marx admitted in Volume 1 that in one respect his theory flatly contradicted the facts, and he promised to sort out this contradiction later. As we have seen, the classical economists and Marx admitted that there were two kinds of situations where actual prices would be different from labor values. One is the case of land or old paintings, where goods cannot be reproduced. The other case is where temporary fluctuations in price are due to changes in supply or demand conditions. But there is another case, pointed out by Ricardo, where prices will in fact differ from labor values. This case is not exceptional. It applies to virtually all produced commodities, and it applies permanently. In fact, from Marx's own theory, it can be shown that virtually all industrial commodities cannot sell at their values defined by labor. Their prices must tend not toward labor values, but very definitely and permanently away from labor values. This third case, where virtually all goods have prices that are permanently different from their values, has been one of the conspicuous objections to Marx's theory. In Marx's theory, machines and other equipment cannot create new value. As they are used up, they merely pass on the value they already contain. Only labor can create new value. Therefore, only labor can create interest or profit. But this implies that interest or profit will be proportionate to wages alone and will not be affected by other production costs. Thus, if $2 worth of labor create a dollar of profit, profits would always equal half of the wages bill, regardless of the capitalist's other expenses. The use of a great deal of capital equipment, or a very small amount, would not affect the profit produced by a given amount of wage labor. Consequently, if capitalists measure their profit against their total outlay, they will make lower profits as a percentage of outlay if they use more capital equipment. In other words, capital-intensive firms will have lower rates of profit than labor-intensive firms. Just to illustrate this point, consider the case of a fully automated factory which employs no living labor at all, but only machines and other equipment. If interest or profit is yielded only by living labor, then a fully automated factory would produce no profit at all for its owners. And the closer factories get to full automation, the more they replace workers with machines, the lower the rate of profit will become. Now, Marx knows perfectly well that this is not true. He knows that capitalists do not measure their profits against labor costs alone, but against their total outlay, including machines, buildings, raw materials, fuel, and land. And Marx knows that competition always tends to equalize this rate of return on total outlay, because capitalists move their investments from low-profit areas to high-profit areas. In the quotation from Marx you are now to hear, notice that constant capital is Marx's name for capital, like machines and buildings, while variable capital is his term for labor.
The law we have demonstrated takes this form. The masses of value and of surplus value produced by different capitals vary directly as the amounts of the variable constituents of these capitals. This law clearly contradicts all experience based on appearance. Everyone knows that a cotton spinner who, reckoning the percentage on the whole of his applied capital, employs much constant and little variable capital, does not, on account of this, pocket less profit or surplus value than a baker, who relatively sets in motion much variable and little constant capital.
Right from the outset of Volume 1 of Capital, Marx frankly acknowledges that his theory is flatly contradicted by observation of the real world, but he promises that this contradiction will be resolved as the theory is developed in later volumes of Capital. However, in the last years of his life, Marx did very little work on capital. Volume 2 was published by Marx's friend, Frederick Engels, in 1885, 2 years after Marx's death. Volume 2 contained no solution, but in the preface, Engels did promise a solution in Volume 3, and he threw out a challenge to anyone to anticipate Marx's solution before it appeared. Many attempts were made by Marxists and non-Marxists. However, the Austrian economist Eugen von Böhm-Bawerk pronounced that a solution was impossible. Either goods do sell at prices in direct proportion to labor values, in which case rates of profit will permanently differ between labor-intensive industries and capital-intensive industries, or rates of profit are equalized by competition, in which case the selling prices of goods permanently diverge from labor values.
There are two possible alternatives. The first alternative is that a permanent system of exchange is really established, whereby goods are exchanged at values which are in proportion to the labor that the respective goods represent. If that alternative obtains, then any equalization of the ratio of surplus proceeds to capital is an impossibility. The second alternative is that such an equalization does not take place. If that alternative obtains, then products cannot possibly continue to be exchanged at values which are in proportion to the labor they represent.
When Volume 3 of Capital did appear in 1894, it turned out that Marx agreed completely with what Böhm-Bawerk had said. Marx admitted that rates of return on different capitals tend to be equal, and therefore that products do not tend to sell at their values as defined by labor time. The actual equilibrium price was made up of labor and capital costs, plus the standard rate of return or normal profit. Marx called this price, at which a commodity will actually tend to sell, its price of production. In 1896, Böhm-Bawerk published his essay, Karl Marx and the Close of His System, the most brilliant criticism of Marx's theory of value.
I cannot help myself. I see here no explanation and reconciliation of a contradiction, but the bare contradiction itself. Marx's third volume contradicts his first.
We should be careful not to misunderstand the issue between Marx and Böhm-Bawerk. Böhm-Bawerk was anxious to emphasize that Volume 1 contradicts Volume 3. But the mere fact of a contradiction does not show that Marx is mistaken. Any theorist who begins with a simplified model and then adds complications later will contradict the simplified model when he adds the complications. In a similar manner, the way machines actually behave contradicts elementary mechanics, where it is assumed that machines operate with 100% efficiency. A physical impossibility. The importance of the contradiction in Marx is twofold. First, Marx gives only one argument in favor of his labor theory of value, and that is the argument about the exchange ratio of corn and iron, which we heard earlier. No other reason is given by Marx for why we should accept his labor theory, and that argument is contradicted by the theory of price of production in Volume 3. So the only reason given by Marx for the labor theory is later destroyed by Marx himself. Second, Marx's introduction of prices of production in Volume 3 suggests that the whole theory of value explained in Volume 1 has been an unnecessary detour, since the prices of production, which emerge in Volume 3, come very close to the commonplace idea that prices are determined by costs of production. Marx claims that even though commodities sell at prices of production, not labor values, these labor values are still necessary to determine prices of production. Even though commodities generally do not sell at their labor values are still essential to a correct explanation of the actual prices commodities do sell at. This is what Marx means by saying that prices of production are transformed values. Marx's attempt to transform values into prices gave rise to a long debate on the question of whether it was possible by mathematical equations to transform labor values into prices without absurd results. This is known as the transformation problem. The outcome of that discussion among Marxist and non-Marxist economists is that such a mathematical transformation cannot be carried out. The usual response of Marxist economists has been that the transformation problem is of no importance. In recent years, however, some Marxist economists have openly abandoned the labor theory of value. For centuries before the 19th century, there had been laws enacted in behalf of employers to keep wages down, sometimes by fixing a maximum wage, sometimes by prohibiting migration, sometimes by persecuting labor unions. In Marx's day, all this had changed. Measures were being taken to lift the restrictions on labor unions and to pass laws limiting hours of work, restricting employment of women and children, enforcing safety regulations in factories, and compelling employers to provide education for their child workers. Marx enthusiastically supported these legislative measures. Marx does not believe that such interventionist reforms are communist or socialist, but he does believe they prepare the way for communism. They are, Marx believes, a salutary reaction against the ideal of laissez-faire, or absence of government interference in industry.
Factory legislation, that first conscious and methodical reaction of society against the spontaneously developed form of the process of production, is just as much the necessary product of modern industry as cotton yarn, self-actors, and the electric telegraph.
Marx would usually deride any claim that some measure had been taken in the interests of that nebulous abstraction, society. And he would insist upon uncovering the interest groups who would benefit by it. However, in endorsing factory legislation, Marx is quite content to rest on the fuzzy notion that legislation can be introduced by society. While Marx was writing Capital, there was a powerful agitation in England to reduce the legal maximum of hours worked by teenage workers from 11.5 hours per day to 10.5 hours per day. The famous economist Nassau Sr. protested against this on the ground that all the capitalist profit was made in the last hour of the working day, implying that a reduction in hours would destroy all the profits and close down all the factories. Marx was full of malicious glee at the foolishness of Sr.'s simple-minded argument, and no doubt the fact that such an eminent economist could make such a serious blunder bolstered Marx's confidence in the rightness of his own analysis. Nassau Sr. subsequently changed his mind and became a supporter of factory legislation. Although such laws did not close down all the factories, they certainly deprived some workers of opportunities. But since production was increasing rapidly, lower working hours were appearing in any case without government intervention. People were prepared to work such long hours because of the general poverty, and this was not cured by legislation, but by increased production. Marx argues that prolonging the working day is one of the chief weapons of the capitalists, and that legislative reduction of the working day is undertaken in behalf of the workers. But since the first laws restricting hours of work were supported mainly by compassionate, wealthy people, there must have been other motivations for compulsory restrictions on working hours. Marx suggests that the more far-seeing capitalists want to check the most extreme exploitation of labor because it would completely destroy the health of the workers, thereby harming the long-term interests of the capitalists. He also points out that the factory acts are promoted by some manufacturing interests because they benefit the bigger and stronger firms by driving some of the weaker and smaller firms out of business. This is another way in which factory legislation hastens the coming of communism, since Marx believes that industrial concentration is a move in the direction of communism.
Factory legislation accelerates the concentration of capital and the exclusive predominance of the factory system. By the destruction of petty and domestic industries, it destroys the last resort of the redundant population, and with it, the sole remaining safety valve of the whole social mechanism. By maturing the material conditions and the combination on a social scale of the processes of production, it matures the contradictions and antagonisms of the capitalist mode of production, and thereby provides, along with the elements for the formation of a new society, the forces for exploding the old one.
When Marx speaks of the last resort of the redundant population, he is recognizing that factory legislation throws some workers out of work and adds to their misery. But he does not display his usual moralizing venom at this point. He does not emphasize that the big manufacturers benefit from factory legislation, partly at the expense of the small manufacturers and partly at the expense of workers made unemployed. We should remember that the capitalists had no power to compel the workers to work long hours. Obviously, anyone who is prepared to perform unhealthy, dangerous work for 18 hours a day, or to send his children out to perform such work, is in a desperate plight. But this desperate plight was in no way the fault of the manufacturing employers. Although Marx defined subsistence in a cultural way, he did believe that competition was continually pushing wages down and would push them below biological subsistence unless the workers resisted. Today this may seem strange, but in 19th century Europe there were such large reserves of poor peasant farmers that whenever industry began to raise wages, poor immigrants would pour in from the countryside, bidding down wages. In this context, any increase in wages seemed very precarious. In the 1840s, Marx believed that the real wages of the workers tended to decline without limit. By the time he came to write Capital, there were clear signs that the long-run trend was for higher wages. So Marx was very careful not to commit himself to the view that the workers must face falling real wages. But he did claim that the workers would become worse off in a more general sense, taking into account increased boredom due to machinery and the increasing hostility between workers and employers.
Within the capitalist system, all methods for raising the social productiveness of labor are brought about at the cost of the individual laborer. All means for the development of production transform themselves into means of domination over and exploitation of the producers. They mutilate the laborer into a fragment of a man, degrade him to the level of an appendage of a machine, destroy every remnant of charm in his work, and turn it into hated toil. They estrange from him the intellectual potentialities of the labor process in the same proportion as science is incorporated in it as an independent power. They distort the conditions under which he works, subject him during the labor process to a despotism the more hateful for its meanness. They transform his time for living into time for working, and drag his wife and child beneath the wheels of the juggernaut of capital. It follows, therefore, that in proportion as capital accumulates, the lot of the laborer, be his payment high or low, must grow worse. Accumulation of wealth at one pole is at the same time accumulation of misery, agony of toil, slavery, ignorance, brutality, mental degradation at the opposite pole.
In his most eloquent and indignant passages about the increasing misery of the workers, Marx is not describing a trend that must occur. He is pointing to a tendency which can be contained or counteracted by trade unions and by legislation. Since Marx expects the working class to carry out the revolution, which will replace capitalism by communism, it is important for his theory that the workers do not become too hopelessly crushed by capitalism. This is why Marx always takes pains to insist that the actual living standards of the workers may very well improve. He also argues that the highly specialized worker tends to give way to the adaptable, versatile worker.
Modern industry, through its catastrophes, imposes the necessity of recognizing, as a fundamental law of production, variation of work. Consequently, fitness of the laborer for varied work. Consequently, the greatest possible development of his varied aptitudes. Modern industry, indeed, compels society, under penalty of death, to replace the detail worker of today, crippled by lifelong repetition of one and the same trivial operation, and thus reduced to the mere fragment of a man, by the fully developed individual, fit for a variety of labors, ready to face any change of production, and to whom the different social functions he performs are but so many modes of giving free scope to his own natural and acquired powers.
This is the end of part 4. Please download part 5 to continue.